Good afternoon, everybody. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, April 7th. We're meeting in room 205 in the Butrovich. Committee members present, our co-chair, vice chair Hughes, Senator Reinbold, and Senator Begich is online. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. We have two items of business up today. First, we'll take up the appointee to the Alaska Mental Trust Board, Ms. Moran, and then we will continue the amendment process on SB 124 as our items of business that we will conduct today. First, like I said, we have our Ms. Moran's on the line. If you could introduce yourself for the record, and state, go over some of your experiences that are relevant to this position on the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board, what position you are filling, if it's a certain role or seat that you are filling, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today and for your consideration of my application to serve on the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board. I am looking to fill one of the seven seats. For the record, my name is Agnes Moran. I was born and raised in Ketchikan. I left Alaska for college in 1978, and I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering from Santa Clara University. My early career was spent in aerospace, working primarily on experimental military satellite systems. I moved into the commercial arena working in computer networking, and then went on to run a private grant-making foundation. I've been on the board of directors of First Bank since 2003. I am the chair of the First Bank Audit Committee and the First Bank Retirement Plans Committee. I returned to Alaska in 1999 to raise my family. My husband is retired. Our daughter is a sophomore at Willamette University, and our son recently graduated from the University of Portland and is attending the Trooper Academy in Sitka. I've been working with trust beneficiaries in a volunteer or professional capacity for more than 10 years. In my volunteer roles, I've worked with individuals experiencing chronic homelessness and substance use disorders. I started by volunteering with my family with a community meal program. It was important to me that my children get to know trust beneficiaries as individuals. I moved on to being one of the founders of the Overnight Warming Center. I joined the board of First City Homeless Services, and I was a member of their board until January of 2021. In January of 2017, I took on the executive director role at Women in Safe Homes, commonly known as WISH in Ketchikan. WISH is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing essential support services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and their families. When I took over WISH, it had been through a rough patch, which was on probation from its major funder, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. It had 150% staff turnover rate. The community had lost faith in the organization to the point where some were calling for WISH to be dissolved, and its grant space was declining. During my tenure, WISH came off probation. My staff has stabilized, and we've been drawing talent to the organization. Our grant space has tripled, and we've expanded our service offerings in the communities we serve. Most importantly, the community turned out in force to celebrate the opening of our new shelter on October 23rd of 2021, which does not currently receive Alaska Mental Health Trust funding and has not received Alaska Mental Health Trust funding during my tenure. At WISH, we work with a full spectrum of trust beneficiaries. We serve participants with traumatic brain injuries, substance dependency, mental health concerns, chronic homelessness, and dementia. We serve infants through the elderly. You describe a condition, and it has probably crossed our threshold. The fundamental quality that a board member must have is a strong connection to the mission of the organization. I've been working and supporting trust beneficiaries in varying capacities for over 10 years. I bring frontline, current experience working with beneficiaries in a rural community, as well as the working knowledge of leading a service-providing organization to the Board of Trustees. With the trust, I want to be an advocate for rural areas of the state and work to extend the reach of the trust by establishing collaborative relationships with the people in the communities working directly with trust beneficiaries. To provide effective programming, we need to learn from the experiences of the people doing the work. I thank you for your time and consideration of my application, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from committee members at this time? Yes, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Agnes, for being willing to serve on this board. Did I say your name right? Okay. And I just find it amazing that you have a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering. You've written bank policies. You've studied women's literature. You worked in the military, done homeless, and then this congratulations on the new shelter. That is really great news. I just don't think we have near enough women's shelters in this state, and safe shelters. So anyway, good job for all that. But my question to you is, what do you see your role being in the mental health, on the Mental Health Trust Board? And do you know how broad, because we have Mental Health Trust right near my house, and I just find it, some of them I believe more could be done with some of the property that benefits the community, and I've been trying for years and years to get something more beneficial to the community in the area. So just in general, how would you describe what your goals, what you see as you serve on the board?
You know, I think the one strong quality I bring to the board is I'm actually doing the work on the ground now, and I see the challenges that we're facing in the rural community. And through my work with the shelters, I'm in contact with, you know, people on the ground throughout the state, you know, from Dillingham to Nome to Bethel, you name it, you know, we talk almost on a weekly basis. And so I think my role will basically be representing the work that's going on the ground in the communities right now. You know, the challenges that are faced by these beneficiaries. You know, I don't have a detox facility in Ketchikan. You know, our mental health services are very limited. So what the issues trust members face in Ketchikan are very different from what trust members face in Anchorage. And that's true for most of rural Alaska.
Follow up, Senator? Senator Hughes.
Yes, I agree with Senator Reinbold. You have an impressive resume. Thank you for stepping up. I was intrigued a little bit, and I don't know if you missed part of the prior question, but the Mental Health Trust lands and the responsibility that the trust has as far as developing those, I just was wondering if you had any thoughts and anything you might be able to bring to the table to enhance that. And then I just wanted to ask you, you started a foster care for animals in need. So when you founded that, were you bringing stray pets and things into your home at that time? I'm just adding that kind to, you know, we don't get to meet you in person. We don't get to sit down and have a conversation in the same room and shake your hands. But I'm picturing that you started that organization bringing, you know, pets into your own home. And is that true? And then just speak a little bit to the mental health lands situation.
Yeah. Right now, yes, I did bring animals into my home. I think my son counted it up at one time, and we've had over 30 different dogs in our house. And right now, I think I have 8 birds. they did come home. We did move most of them on. I think I'm down to 3 dogs right now that were not, for one reason or another, able to transition out of our house. The land, I'm going to have to work on that. That is probably the one area where I am the weakest. But, you know, I've looked at what they've been doing in some of the areas with the leases, with the land trust swap, what they've done recently down here. That's one area that I'm going to need to get smarter on. So I don't have a well-formed opinion on that right now, but I can get back to you on that.
Well, thank you, Agnes, Mr. Chair. I have no doubt that you will get trained up and understand it a lot more, assuming that you are confirmed just based on your resume. So you bring a lot of other good things to the table, and that is an important one, and I'm confident that you will end up, you know, initially you'll be drinking from a fire hose on that one, but after time I'm sure you will be a positive contribution in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Begich, do you have any questions for the conferee before us today?
Not at this time. The other members have asked my question.
Thank you. I do have a question, Ms. Moran. Mm-hmm. I used to be a director of one of your sister organizations, and I truly understand the issue that WISH went through with the council, and I commend you on your efforts to turn that organization around, because I do remember the public testimony during the granting scoring of that agency at that time. And so thank you for making sure that we still have this organization in Southeast. But my question has to do with maybe not direct funds that you may receive from the council, not from the council, but from the Mental Health Trust Board, but indirect. I know that I didn't know if this organization takes funding from Alaska Housing Corporation in terms of either ESG grants, emergency sheltering grants, or other types of basic homeless assistance programs, which is funded, and I think they have to provide data back to the trust. Just didn't know if your organization was one of the recipients of one of those type of grants that may be a pass-through grant.
We do have some emergency housing vouchers that come through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, so we do have that. The ESG funding we have is all COVID-related. And then we do receive Treasury funds, again, that are COVID-related.
Okay. Thank you. And also for your knowledge, the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust is in the room, not for your testimony maybe, but I think he's here on another piece of legislation before us today. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you. I just thought of something else that, and again, this is assuming you are confirmed. I would just like to highlight something that I hope as a member of the trust you would pay attention to, with the idea maybe down the road the trust could get behind it and help replicate it. And that is a pilot project that is going on right now to reduce recidivism. And it is Set Free Alaska is doing that with a residential campus, very kind of a holistic, comprehensive as far as substance abuse counseling, job training, actually going out and getting a job, learning how to manage finance, family counseling, all those kind of things that will allow these folks to be successful when they enter back into the community. So I just would ask that you keep an eye on that, because I had a chance to visit that location. The pilot's underway. It's going well. They've been very good, this organization has been, as far as collecting data. And that's one of the reasons why they were awarded the grant to do the pilot project, with the hope that the data will show this is a successful model. And the Mental Health Trust has been involved with that organization off and on. And I just ask that you keep an eye on it, because to me it's a glimmer of hope as a way to increase public safety in this state and have these folks become productive citizens rather than committing worse crimes and ending back in our prison system, so and harming the community when they do. So anyway, I just want to highlight that for you, that you keep an eye on that. Thank you, Agnes.
Yeah, I will definitely keep an eye on that. And with my engineering background, I'm all about the data, so I do appreciate looking at data.
Thank you. At this time, we will open public testimony. Does anyone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify for Ms. Agnes Moore? Seeing none and seeing no one online, we will close public testimony. Any other further comments or questions from committee members? Sorry, Senator Hughes.
What do we have? At ease, please. So do I.
You're back on the record, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In accordance with Alaska Statute 39.05.080, the Health and Social Services Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Alaska Mental Health Trust Board of Trustees, Agnes Moran. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions.
All right. With that, hearing no objection, the appointee will be forwarded on joint session. We'll take an IDE to sign the document. We are back on the record. We're now going to continue on with Senate Bill 124. This is the committee's eighth time hearing this bill. We first heard this bill on April 27th of 2021, 5-4, 2021, 8-3-8, 22, 3-15, 3-17, 3-22, and 3-29, and today. Our goal is hopefully is to finish up the amendment process today. And so with that, we are on Amendment 28. For folks following along, these are all been uploaded to BASIS, and we are going through that process. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment Number 28.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So this is on page 2, the line 12, and then also page 2, line 30. It's just deleting. You all know that I have a real problem with the broad definition of mental health professional. So this just makes sure that a physician is making sure to inform the arresting officer of the decision to leave the crisis center. I just wanted to make sure that somebody who was very aware and very astute and aware of the patient to be able to communicate regarding leaving the crisis stabilization center, and I believe it's next, would potentially go into the crisis residential center.
All right. Is there discussion on amendment number 28? Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I think Senator Costello brought this up last time, and the situation is it's going to be the paramedics and those that are out on the street. The physician wouldn't be out on the street where, you know, for instance, someone might be in the middle of the road, declothing or something like that. It's not going to be the physician that would interact with them. And so for that reason, I don't think we should limit it to the physician.
Okay. Any other further conversation? Hearing none, your closing remarks, Senator Reinbold.
Once again, I just feel like there's massive loopholes. Although I understand that there's a need for change, and I understand that, and I'm absolutely happy to work towards that change. I just think that there's far too many loopholes, and I want to make sure around every corner I can to make sure that a legitimate person is involved and that is actually well-trained, and that's the reason that I brought this this up. I just want to make sure physicians are involved with something so serious as a crisis stabilization center. So that's the reason I brought this amendment forth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. As we do a roll call vote, I'll yell out Senator Baggage so he knows it's his turn, as our moderator does not have a mic that he can know when it's his turn to speak. So we'll do a roll call vote.
Senator Baggage.
And Baggage?
No.
Senator Hughes?
No.
Yes.
No.
One yay, three nays.
With one yay and three nays, Amendment 28 fails, which brings us to Amendment 29. Senator Reinbold.
Can I get 1 second, please?
Yep. At ease?
Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to...
On the record, Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw Amendment Number 29. There were a few. I was trying to revert it back to original language, but there's a couple little technical things that in drafting errors, and so I need to withdraw this one.
All right. Amendment Number 29, so no objections, been withdrawn. Brings us to Amendment 30.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 30.
I'll object, Senator Reinbold.
So on page 3, line 31. This just changes probable cause to clear and convincing evidence. Once again, I think there's just so many loopholes for abuse in this bill, and that's why I'm just trying to tighten it up so it's very clear rather than just probably or probable cause. This actually says clear and convincing evidence that the person is gravely disabled or suffering from mental illness. And we didn't get the word serious in there, which was really, really important to me. So this amendment's pretty important to me, just to make sure that this bill is not exploited or used by people with ill intent. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes.
Yes, could we have Captain Wilson speak to this so we'll better understand clear and convincing evidence? I know that's used in civil court, but I'm not sure how it's used on the street when an officer might encounter someone. So I'm wondering if Captain Wilson could speak to that.
Yes, Captain Wilson, are you on the online, and did you hear Senator Hughes' question? And for the record, just want to say for the record, no relations. This is not my alter ego calling in. I'm not a ventriloquist. Captain Wilson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Captain David Wilson, two L's in Wilson, differentiating me from the esteemed chairman. I'm an Alaska State Trooper currently assigned to the AST Director's Office. I'm calling from Anchorage. And in regard to Amendment 30 and the change of language, Senator Hughes, through the chair, clear and convincing evidence is a civil standard, and that's not one that we train our troopers in. They're very familiar with probable cause and the circumstances that need to be articulated in order to support a probable cause finding, but clear and convincing evidence, we don't train them in. And so there would be some initial confusion and certainly some training and time required to adopt new language in that regard, and so you can imagine, I'm sure, the problems that might result from that.
All right, Senator Hughes, follow-up?
And follow-up, can you explain to us what probable cause? I know we've talked about that before, but just as we're thinking about it, so right now the probable cause is used, so how would an officer evaluate the situation and under that probable clause guideline?
Certainly. The general definition of probable cause involves that a reasonable person would believe that the circumstances or evidence exists for the condition in question. So in this case, that the person is gravely disabled or suffering from mental illness. So a reasonable person standard is part of the probable cause determination. And so that's something that we're familiar with. And applying for search warrants and making arrest decisions is something troopers regularly evaluate every day.
And follow up. So a reasonable person evaluating, would they not be looking for some sense of what might be considered evidence? I mean, they just couldn't see a person and take them. They'd have to be picking up on certain things, would they not?
Certainly, yeah. So Senator Hughes, through the chair, the reasonable person standard is one where we look at someone who is disinterested, not involved in an emotional event, not impaired by alcohol or drugs or any sort of, you know, errant circumstances, and looking at the evidence available, such as statements made by the person in question, witness statements, or the totality of circumstances, and making a determination based on that information.
So it does involve some kind of evidence as far as they just can't do it on a whim. There actually have to be things they can point to, just to kind of restate what you said.
Senator Hughes, to the chair, absolutely. You have to have evidence in order to meet the probable cause standard. The evidence that we gather often is physical or testimonial, is certainly more than just more likely than not, which is another civil standard of preponderance of the evidence sort of thing. It's certainly not as high as beyond a reasonable doubt, which is required for convictions in court, but it's still a substantial standard, and it's difficult to meet without doing a significant amount of investigation and fact-finding in order to meet that expectation.
And one more follow-up. So let's talk about something that would be a very serious crime. Before an officer would act, is there a higher standard than probable crime, for instance, is there any other standard that an officer used for different types of crimes or situations other than probable cause? For non-civil.
Senator Houston, the chair. No, probable cause is the primary standard used for taking action. There's a lesser standard, reasonable suspicion, for example, if we were to, sometimes we use that in certain cases for stops and detains and searches on vehicles with dogs and that sort of thing. But as far as higher than probable cause, there is no standard other than that required in court. We train our troopers on probable cause and beyond a reasonable doubt, and that takes care of the vast majority of police contact.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Further discussion for closeout, Senator Reinbold. Question for Captain Wilson, Senator Reinbold.
So, Captain Wilson, thanks for being with us today. So, I just want to reiterate that you said that there's only one. You only use probable cause for criminal. Is that what you said? Except in court.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, for decisions out in the field, for example, gathering evidence to put into an affidavit for an arrest or into an affidavit for a search warrant, we use probable cause. Beyond a reasonable doubt is a standard we use for ascertaining whether or not an investigation is complete and whether or not it's because the ultimate standard there is it's going to move forward in a court setting. So those are the two standards that are used very regularly in dictating how we judge our investigations and at what point action needs to be taken. At some point, for example, in an example such as an arrest, beyond a reasonable doubt is not a standard when you can always have the luxury of meeting before making an arrest because we have to weigh public safety and the necessity of stopping damage from occurring, for example, to persons and such. So probable cause standard is used at the arrest level, but quite often if an investigation is moving forward, we're of course not stopping there and continuing to investigate, and that's where we eventually will reach the beyond a reasonable doubt standard if the investigation moves forward.
Senator Ramble?
Okay, so to me, this is a big deal to be taking somebody off the street and putting them in a stabilization and potentially injecting them, you know, with psychotropic medications and keeping them for quite some time, potentially, and sometimes with ex parte orders and sometimes without even parental consent or a consult with the parent. And so this bill just to me is rife with error still at this point in time. But what amazes me is probable cause to me still is a probably. And so to put someone, you know, pull someone off the street for a probable cause, to me that still just, it just seems like that's amazing to me that I actually never knew that a criminal case would just be based on probable cause. So is there any other word we could use here beside probable cause or no? Because I think clear and convincing evidence, even though it's a civil standard, don't think it'd be that hard to train you guys on. You guys go to camp or whatever in Sitka to training facilities, and I'm not sure it probably would not take that much extra effort to do clear and convincing evidence.
Is that a question for Captain Wilson? Sure. Captain Wilson?
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Reinbold, through the chair. If we're trained to use a different standard, then we'll use a different standard, for sure. And probable cause standard is one that we currently use, and so we're very familiar with what's required to reach that level. But all of the arrests that are currently made in the state of Alaska are based on at least the probable cause standard. So that's the minimum standard that we've been trained is acceptable in our society and in our courts for affidavits in support of arrest and also for search warrants to get past the Fourth Amendment rights of a citizen. So that's pretty much standard and acceptable as we are trained, and that's how we operate right now.
Right, Senator Ramble.
So just clarification, I guess what you're saying is no, there's not another word you can use. And I mean, correct me if that's incorrect. And second, do you have, once again, reiterate the probable cause standard on record? This is important because people might come back and watch this and listen to intent. So I do want the probable cause put on the record.
Certainly. Senator Reinbold, through the chair. No, I'm not aware of any other standard that we use above probable cause other than beyond a reasonable doubt for everyday business in the field. To explain Probable cause, in simple terms, is the standard of evidence unnecessary that a reasonable person would use based on the facts and circumstances available that the condition exists. So in this example, that a person is gravely disabled or suffering from mental illness.
Senator Reinbold, your closing.
Well, through the chair, I was just going to ask, how would he define mental illness? Because it's not serious mental illness, it's just mental illness. And as you know, some Democrats think Republicans are and vice versa. So a reasonable person could think somebody on the political spectrum is. And so I think it's important to get the definition of a trooper who might be picking somebody off the street, what their definition would be. I think it's important to get on there. I think serious has to be put in here.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, if I were making a detention for transporting someone to a crisis stabilization center based on the statute as proposed, then I would make sure that I have probable cause, as the statute is proposed statute lists, that person is gravely disabled or suffering from mental illness and likely to cause serious harm to self or others of such immediate nature that considerations of safety do not allow initiation of involuntary commitment procedures. So some of the examples that I've had from my own experience are someone who has initiated attempts to harm themselves already, or they have attempted to harm someone else, or they have stated an intention to do so after a conversation that I have with them. Those are the kinds of things that would lead me to believe that detention and transport would be necessary.
All right, Senator Reinbold, wrap up on your...
Wraps up.
Yeah, Sandra Hias.
So I think it's important, in case people haven't listened, because I think part of this bill going through, and if it passes, this record's really important. And we did very clearly here, in at least in one other meeting on this bill, that an officer would be in full violation if he or she were arresting someone for political differences. So that officer would be in violation. So that has been settled on the record and is associated with this bill if it were to pass. So that's a good thing, and I'm glad we've had that conversation. I'm also, as far as the question of probable cause and the difference, Captain Wilson did say, Mr. Chair, that there is a lower standard. It had the word suspicion in it. I can't remember what the phrase was. And also he put on the record that some type of specific evidence would have to be evident at the scene with the person. So it could not be on a whim. It couldn't just be, you know, looking at the person. They'd have to really have some clear indication that there is a serious mental health situation and a concern about harm and endangerment. So I just want to have that accompany this, that probable cause does involve all those things. So I'm comfortable with the language probable cause and not introducing a new thing in that if all the criminal law hasn't had something other than that, and that the beyond a reasonable doubt is associated with things going to the courtroom. Thank you.
All right. And wrap up, Senator Reinbold.
So I didn't want to go here, but I'm going here. There's been a situation where I've been involved in recently with probable cause. Somebody said I solely blocked someone because of X, Y, and Z. And the truth is exactly the opposite in regards to it was for something completely different. And it was for somebody that had been known, had harassed me in the past. And so this is why this is so bothersome to me, is that probable cause to me is probably, and it can be in the mind of somebody, I had never went before the committee, and that's why I never had, because of litigation, I never was able to explain myself, but this probable cause really bothers me, and I do believe we need a challenge, because especially when somebody never got to go and explain themselves and discuss what was going on, and then people independently went and made this impugning decision. To me, it's a big deal, a probable cause. So that's why I will not withdraw this, because I think we probably need to go look at criminal standards and change them. Because what I've been seeing going on in Canada and Australia and Russia right now, this bill is of deep concern. So the people aren't going to come back and listen to this hearing and say it's supposed to say serious, you know, on page 4. It's not. It doesn't say serious. It's the bottom line, and they're going to read it for what it is, and they're not going to read you know, clear and convincing evidence potentially, they're going to use probable cause. And so that's why I do think that we need a higher standard, especially if you're going to do something that is so severe as take somebody off of the street and put them in into one of these facilities. So I'm gonna keep the amendment.
All right. With that, we'll do a roll call vote.
Yes.
Senator Baggage?
No.
No.
No. With one yay and three nays, Amendment 30 fails. Where it brings us to Amendment 31. Senator Reinbold. Oh, before we go to Senator Reinbold, just want to let folks know online who we have available for questions in case Senator Baggage can't see the room. We have Steve Williams, the CEO of Alaska Mental Health Trust here. We have Nancy Mead, the Alaska Court System. Kelly House here from the Department of Public Safety. We have Renee McFarland, our Alaska Public Defender, online. We have Jennifer Johnson Monroe, the Director of Behavioral Health, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health online. Steve Bookman, our Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Law, is also online from the departments if you have any questions to ask for them. Senator Reinbold.
This is just going to the same train of thought as before, except this. Oh, I'm sorry. Move Amendment number 31.
Yes, thank you, Senator Reinbold. I'll object.
Okay, so Amendment 31 basically just continues the same line of thought, but once again, it has an examination by a licensed physician. I think there's lots of physicians out there, lots of emergency room doctors and things like that. I just think a physician needs to be involved much sooner in the process, and that's what Amendment number 31, it just makes sure that a licensed physician is involved.
Sure. All right, Senator Hughes.
As much as I agree with Senator Reinbold as ensuring that patients or individuals aren't incorrectly brought into one of these clinics, this just isn't practical. So imagine a person that's very disoriented jumping out in front of cars, and they need to be an examination by a physician at that point. It's just not going to be practical. Again, the physician is going to be at the clinic, and we'll do the examination there. So it just wouldn't actually work in the real world and how these situations unfold, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Yes, I actually have had a friend that had a real-life experience specifically on this matter. He, in fact, Senator Hughes mentioned last time about a person walking down the street without clothes on. This was a person going through a mental breakdown on the Glen Highway. They, in fact, were walking down the street with no clothes on. There was no time to get a medical doctor there. There had been no way to do it. The troopers were able to get that person to Providence, but they did have an examination in an appropriate setting. I would be opposed to this amendment.
All right. Senator Reinbold, in closing.
So basically what this does is this is prior to admission. That's why I think it's so important that a physician's involved prior to admission. So with that, I will maintain this. I do believe before admission that a licensed physician needs to examine this person to close a loophole that I think could be exploited in the future. With that, I urge a yes vote.
We need to clarify something, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I realize that was closing, but in the statute, it's actually prior to being taken into custody, not prior to admission.
Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, this is having to do with the Section 13, 473707, which is admission to hold at a crisis stabilization center. And it says a respondent that is not willing to go voluntarily. This deals with page 1, line 4. To make sure that somebody is examined before they're admitted, basically. So I just think it's really important.
With that, we'll go with the roll call vote. Senator Baggage?
No.
Senator
Hughes?
No.
Senator Reinbold? Yes.
No. One yay and three nays. Amendment 32 fails. Moves us to Amendment 33. I'm sorry, 32.
Sorry. You wish. Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment number 32.
I'll object for explanation.
Mr. Chairman, this is on page 4, lines 7 and 8. So, once again, this just says a person taken into consideration. The bill removes for emergency evaluation. All as this amendment does is add for emergency evaluation. Once again, I want an accurate evaluation of the person, not just hearsay or probable cause or reasonable people thinking maybe. I just want there to be more safeguards in the bill. So with that, I would like the emergency evaluation to be placed in the bill.
Thank you for the explanation. I will remove my objection as a further objection to Amendment 32. Hearing none, Amendment 32 passes. On to Amendment 33, Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 33.
I'll object, Senator Reinbold.
This deletes Section 13 of the bill, where so many of the problems I have with the bill are.
All right. Is there discussion on Amendment 33?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
So right now the status quo situation is that a person is being, if we don't, we've got a lot of good amendments that we've done to this bill, but let's say this bill fails and we are at the status quo. That means the officer is taking a person to the jail or the hospital where family won't have access to them. These clinics, I know the one in our area is the person who is doing it is working as in a faith-based clinic and is going to be setting that up. It's going to be an outpatient kind of thing where a pastor could come or family could come. It's not going to be in a hospital situation where the family might be cut off from the person or in a jail setting. So, this is an improvement. And also, if this passes, like we talked about before, a lot of things we've got on the record will carry with this, including, taking someone into custody for political differences. So what this does, it pretty much guts the bill so that we couldn't have these, what I'm seeing more like an outpatient setting for a person. So for that reason, I'm going to be opposing the amendment.
Thank you. I think that, just to add, I think that this amendment would basically delete the purpose of the bill, which was to fix the situation from the Disability Law Center. And then we would go back to the same system with another system being in place of using our Department of Corrections as a housing entity for these folks in crises without having an alternative place to send them. Any other further comment on this amendment? Seeing none, Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so basically the status quo right now, I just talked to a chief of police, and they said they're happy with just taking them to the hospital because they know there's licensed physicians there, and there's in the diagnosed areas, they can have triage, and they can get them the mental health that they need. So they didn't mind at all the way that it was working right now. So with the way it is right now, if someone is charged, then they know what they're being charged with, and they have a lot of legal rights. They've got defendant's rights. So they have lots of constitutional protections. So some people would actually prefer actually being charged rather than just a probable cause of somebody they think might be maybe. And so that's why I think that Section 13 causes tremendous controversy and loopholes. I don't mind dealing with the specific issue with the disability law, but this bill does far more than that. And some people are worried that these little hospitals, these little mental stabilization units and residential areas might end up being worse than jail because they can be injected with psychotropic drugs without informed consent. And so once again, I'm going to keep this amendment here because I think that Section 13 causes grave concerns in this bill as it stands right now because we did not get the bookmarks in there we needed to. Thank you.
All right. We'll go to roll call vote.
Yes.
Senator Baggage?
No.
No.
Senator
Wilson?
No.
One yay, three nays.
One yay and three nays. Amendment 33 fails. Brings us to Amendment 34. Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 34.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So this one is on page 8, line 28, if everyone wants to get there. Basically, instead of reason to believe, this is compelling. If they have a compelling reason to believe. Once again, I'm just starting to put as many bookmarks that I can or bookends so that people can't just willy-nilly a reason to believe that someone's mentally ill. I mean, with the hostility of political situations and even with COVID, there's been tremendous hostility towards people. And I just think that I think it's really important that we put, instead of just reason, that it has to be a compelling reason to believe in. So it's just adding basically one word, making it so that there's stronger and more protections for the patient. That's the intent of every single one of my amendments, is to protect the patient.
All right. And I will phone just someone to get the legal definition of compelling. We'll ask Mr. Bookman if he could talk a little bit about sort of this language of using this word compelling in this amendment. Mr. Bookman, are you following us along on Amendment 34?
I am. And through the chair, for Senator, to answer the question, I guess the concern is that compelling is not a burden of proof. As was stated earlier, you could have a burden of proof like reasonable suspicion or probable cause or clear and convincing evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt. We didn't talk about preponderance of the evidence, but that's one of them. Compelling is not any of those, and so I don't know how anyone would interpret that.
Further conversation? Senator Hughes.
Actually, this isn't so much, it's not the officer having compelling reason. It's actually the medical provider having a compelling reason. And I don't know if we have anyone to speak to that piece, because I wouldn't be so worried about how the courts might interpret it. I want to know when a medical professional makes the decision, what is their standard of reason? Do we have anybody that can speak to that?
Senator, through the chair, I could speak to that. I did work in a former job on some medical cases, and I've also obviously presented the testimony of doctors. In terms of when doctors are talking about the medical judgments they make, the question the courts look to is whether they have made those decisions to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. The other evidence standards that we talked about are for judges, for jurors.
So as follow-up, so if they have reason, that means they have to have a certain medical certainty. So that would be essentially, it would be a compelling reason. It couldn't be a willy-nilly reason. It would have to be something where they have medical certainty. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, thank you. I guess I could ask Mr. Bookman another question.
Yes,
association. Does having the word compelling hurt anything? Because now we're not talking about a standard for the courts. We're talking about the standard for the medical provider.
Through the chair, I think it will introduce a real degree of confusion among medical professionals, and it will make it much less likely that this bill will work as intended. Medical professionals are always very concerned about following the law and doing the right thing, and with there being no clear definition of compelling and no analog that they could refer it to, I fear it would greatly affect the practical workings of this bill.
And then just as follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Based on the standard of medical certainty, compelling is really already embedded in this. Is that correct? Because if you have something that you're certain,
right,
medically certain about, it's
through
a
the
good
chair,
reason.
Then yes, I would agree with that. I'm not a medical ethicist, but I know that they don't make their decisions lightly. Yeah, I should stop there.
as follow-up, now that we know that it has to be a really good reason, I'm comfortable with the language as is. I don't want to create confusion for the physicians and the providers, so I will be opposing this.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold.
So, Mr. Bookman, you said that if the word compelling is in there, then it would not meet the intent of the bill. What is your intent of the bill?
Through the chair, Senator, while obviously I think it's the governor's bill, it's the administration's bill, but I think the idea is to provide less restrictive alternatives for mental health care and a broader spectrum of care so that people are not having to wait in inappropriate places like emergency rooms or jails, but can have their specialized needs met and returned to the community as quickly as possible.
And a ramble.
So with that, I mean, people could say it's inappropriate to be held in one of these potentially mini jails, a mental health mini jails. So we don't know exactly what all this is going to look like in the future, but you were conflicting in your testimony when you said compelling might already be in there. When I just Googled it really fast, what compelling meant is convincing. So you said you don't know how anyone could interpret it. It's very easy to interpret compelling or convincing are basically synonymous, and so that's why this is very simple. She said she had no problem with it at first, and then we never get to weigh in how to run the government, and somehow you guys in the executive branch always gets to weigh in on legislation, which I just find amazing to me because we're the legislators, but with that, I genuinely believe that if it's no problem to add the word compelling or convincing, then I think the amendment should pass.
With that, we'll go to a roll call vote. Senator Begich.
No.
No.
Yes.
No. One yay and three nays. Amendment 34 fails. Brings us to amendment number 35. Senator Reinbold.
I move amendment number 35.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
This removes Section 15 regarding ex parte.
Right.
The intent of it is to ensure that the patient has representation. Once again, it's another loophole. I believe that patients need representation, and that's why I put this in here.
All right. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I think we need some clarification because I'm looking at this. I'm thinking it's actually the patient, or I keep calling them the patient, the person is actually losing some protection because it's removing the requirement for an ex parte order. So I don't know if we can have someone, maybe I'm confused, but I think we're removing some protection here that we should be leaving in place.
I think the person that you're looking for is standing and coming to the front to answer that question for you, Senator Hughes. We have Ms. Nancy Mead from the Alaska court system. If you want to place yourself on the record and sort of answer our Senator Hughes' question on would this removing an ex parte order be removing some judicial protection, I think it's our question.
Thank you for the record. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska court system. As I understand, Section 15 and subsection C would be removed by this amendment, lines 8 through 11. This is in situations where somebody, the mental health professional, has caused a respondent, the person, to be either hospitalized or admitted to one of the crisis centers, and they had to do it in an emergency situation where they hadn't previously gotten any court order. So C, I would actually agree through the chair with Senator Hughes. This is where some process takes place in front of the court. By eliminating it, I do fear that it would remove any court involvement and there would be a gap. That is, the person was admitted, but there's no provision without C for bringing it before the judge.
And just as a clarifying question then, that would change and then the whole 70, there wouldn't be a 72-hour. That person can be just held there for indefinite without having been brought before the court.
To the chair, Yes, that would appear to just create a gap where somebody is allowed to detain somebody without any process. And so C is the provision that provides that you do need to go back before the court and get the order that you didn't have time to get previously.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I'm sorry, Senator Reinbold.
With that was not the intent that I had. The intent was that I wanted these patients to always have representation, even from initiation. So with that, I believe I'll withdraw the amendment, and thank you for being here today. Clarification was helpful.
Thank you. And with that, amendment.
Yeah, because I believe that the intent was missed in the legislation in drafting somehow. So with that, yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw amendment number 35. That was certainly not the intent.
Amendment number 35 has been withdrawn. Well, brings us to amendment 36. Senator Reinbold.
And Mr. Chairman, I move amendment 36.
All right. I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So I just needed clarification in regards to this. This was petitioner versus prosecuting, and I really didn't understand the difference between the two. And so that's the reason I brought this amendment forth. If someone could get on the record and explain the difference between the petitioners and the prosecuting, that would be helpful. I may or may not withdraw this.
I think Mr. Bookman is the attorney that could probably give a best definition to petitioner versus prosecuting.
Yes, thank you. I'm Stephen Buckland with the Department of Law, and through the chair, Senator, a prosecutor is one who pursues a criminal case, and a petitioner is somebody who is petitioning, who's asking the court for something. So having the word prosecutor in there has a connotation that the respondent has committed a crime.
Right. Further clarification, Senator Reinbold.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to tell you what, again, my intent was in regards to this is, once again, I mean, some people actually would rather be charged with something because they know then exactly what they're being accused of, and then they get legal protections and all that. With this petitioner, I understand, you know, why you guys are doing this in regards to this bill now, but once again, I was just trying to put more power in the patient's hand, and with that was the intent. But I think I will withdraw this because it actually isn't because they're not getting pressed charges. This is something it sounds like they might choose in an alternative. That I'm going to go ahead and withdraw number 36.
All right. With that, amendment number 36 has been withdrawn. That brings us to amendment 37. Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment 37.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
This basically removes Section 18 of the bill, so the extensions and the three periods that they can hold the patient. I just believe that that's too much time, and so that's why I removed Section 18, because these people have no charges, and I just don't want these to become a mini federal prison or federal money, you know, where a bunch of, you know, like right now with the COVID patients, it's over $300,000 per COVID patient with all this federal money flowing in. I just don't want this to be one more opportunity to scoop people up and detain them and keep them in these different facilities, you know, without any charges or anything like that. And then now indefinitely almost with three extended periods. And that's why I put this amendment to remove Section 18 out of the bill.
Is there further conversation, debate on amendment? Senator Hughes.
Yes, this goes back to the conversations that we've had at a number of hearings, and we've talked about the person with a heart condition, and their lives have to be saved with medicine, even though there might not be time to talk to the spouse or the parent or whoever. And but as a reminder, when any meds are administered, they are the last resort, and only, you know, to ensure the patient doesn't hurt him or herself or someone else. And the providers also have to document everything else they've tried beforehand. And if we took this part out, that wouldn't be happening, and we would be going back to tying or restraining the person up, which that can actually be an unsafe too, where the person can hurt themselves if they thrash around. So because they have to document everything leading up to that, and those documents, the parent or guardian would be able to see those, the courts could see that documentation. I'm comfortable leaving this in here. I don't want to see us physically restraining people. That might be dangerous too in itself. So I'm going to be opposing it.
All right. Is there further debate? Saying none. Senator Reinbolt.
Well, I didn't know if I'm debate or closing comments, but Mr. Chairman, we've talked before. You guys voted down a lot of the amendments that would cause psychotropic drugs to be the last resort. She misstated what you guys said before, so you might want to clarify what your intent is if someone comes back and because when I had an amendment for psychotropic drugs to be used as the last resort to try to protect them, but you guys didn't support that. That's my recollection. And so bottom line is this does, Section 18 does talk about psychotropic drugs. And so I do think that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important.
Mr. Chair, can we get clarified on the record if it is indeed the last resort?
Sure. You know, I think that I was just going to go to I was going to bother our division director of behavioral. No, all right. I was just going to go, and I haven't got to hear her all this time period.
Mr. Chairman, it's Amendment 17.
And that was in reference to Amendment 17, but I believe Ms. Carpenter would be more fun to.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, the use of crisis medication per our statutes is used as a last resort option. And Mr. Bookman could offer some more clarification of how it is listed in the statutes, but they have to show all of the other interventions they have done. And that is the last option when somebody is physically harming themselves, an imminent danger to themselves, or say the provider who's providing care, that there's no other safe alternative.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. Can you give me the statute that says that? The exact statute that says that even with this new law on the books, potentially, where does it say specifically that psychotropic drugs in residential facilities or stabilization will be the last? Because I tried to get that amendment in, and these guys voted it down, and so I can't see exactly in statute where it is.
Did Mr. Bookman have that handy? Mr. Bookman? Did you hear Senator Reinbold's question?
I did, and yes, I'm Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law. And through the chair, Senator, Alaska Statute 4730-838A1 states that the staff's response to the behavioral or condition must be documented in the patient's medical record. The documentation must include an explanation of alternative responses to the crisis that were considered or attempted by the staff and why those responses were not sufficient.
Senator Reinbold.
So that even makes it weaker because that's an attempt, you know, a possibility or a consideration. It does not ever say it will be used as the last area of resort. So that certainly didn't help one bit. It actually muddied the waters quite a bit. And also the concern with some of the advocates that I've been working with are concerned that some of the old statutes aren't going to apply to the new statutes. And that's what I want as clear as day on record, if that's our intent, that the psychotropics but drugs, even in these new facilities, are the last record of resort, then that needs to be clear. And it sounds like that's what Heather was putting on the record. And if that's so, I hope that's the case. I just want to make sure it's clear.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Mr. Bookman, so you read the part that they had to consider and try other things and document it. Is that language leading up to before they can use medications? In other words, do we have something that shows, because it was said in a previous, and I think that's perhaps why we didn't accept the prior amendment, because it was already in statute that it's a last resort. So do you have something better to read to us from the statute that it's a last resort?
Yes, I apologize again, Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law, and through the chair. Senator, I'm sorry, when you look at paragraph A of that, before one, it says that a crisis medication may be administered without informed consent, comma, only if, right? And so that documentation has to exist before the crisis medication can be used.
Thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
Can you read it one more time? Because I think you said it must be considered and documented. It doesn't say tried, so I think there was a misstatement on record. I just want to make sure this is a big deal. To me, using psychotropic medications without informed consent is one of the biggest red flags in this entire bill, and they can cause tremendous harm. They can cause people to go into psychosis and suicidal and harm others and violent. If you go look at the records, I mean, it's there's tremendous research about the side effects of psychotropic drugs. So this is a big deal. So yes, I would like you to read exactly what you said on record, with the intent saying, even in these residential facilities, the intent of this bill is for psychotropic drugs to be used as the last resort.
Yes, through the chair, Senator, I'll read out all of 838, paragraph A and subparagraph A1. Except as provided in C and D of this section, an evaluation facility or designated treatment facility may administer psychotropic medication to a patient without the patient's informed consent, regardless of whether the patient is capable of giving informed consent, only if, subparagraph 1, there is a crisis situation or an impending crisis situation that requires immediate use of the medication to preserve the life of or prevent significant physical harm to the patient or another person, as determined by a physician, physician assistant, or advanced practice registered nurse. The behavior or condition of the patient giving rise to a crisis under this paragraph and the staff's response to the behavior or condition must be documented in the patient's medical record. The documentation must include an explanation of alternative responses to the crisis that were considered or attempted by the staff and why those responses were not of subparagraph 1.
Senator Rembel.
So the intent is, of this bill, including the new facilities, psychotropic drugs will be used as a last resort. Is that correct?
Yes, verbal de-escalation techniques or other techniques would always be used first.
So, Mr. Chairman, so is that a yes, psychotropic drugs are the last intent? Is that a yes? As a last resort, psychotropic drugs, even in these new facilities, is that correct?
Yes.
Any further debate on this amendment? All right. We'll go to a roll call vote.
No.
Yes.
Senator Baggage.
No.
No. One yay and three nays. Amendment 37 fails. Brings us to Amendment 38.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 38.
Object, Senator Rambold.
So, again, this was working with some advocates. And so basically where this is on page 11, if people want to know exactly where the bill is, you know, where the amendment is in reference to. And it starts on line 2. So this is in regards to section 19. And so what this amendment basically does is it adds a new section where it's health outcome metrics. And it sounded like everybody on the committee wanted good outcomes and to be able to measure. So basically, this has a crisis residence center, stabilization center, or subacute mental facility shall assess the severity of the mental illness and keep a record of the assessment, and shall use an objective scale relating to the individual's ability to function in society and the impact the mental health has on one's daily life. And then B goes over crisis residential centers, stabilization centers, or subacute mental facilities will record the number of patients involuntary detained, the number of patients whom the psychotropic medication are administered without informed consent, and the number of patients physically restrained, patient complaints, patient injuries, traumatic events. C, it goes over to those same facilities shall submit a quarterly report to the division responsible for behavioral health services relating to the aggregate assessment of data gathered. And then it goes into the division, will prepare semi-annual reports. So basically, this is more like evidence-based. According to the World Psychiatric, there was an association that basically says coercion. This is World Health Organization stuff and World Psychiatric, and they said coercion techniques just don't work. It's just the bottom line. And that's what my biggest fear with this bill is coercion, uninformed consent, administering psychotropic drugs. It seems, so basically this does is it just gives metrics so that they're measured and that there's really, really good reporting. So if something's not working, we know. And if something is working, we know. And this is more patient advocacy. Once again, I work with a patient advocate organization on this amendment. It was flagged as one of the few that were really important. So with that, I urge a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Further conversation? Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I'm not sure if Heather's going to be I'm looking at Section 26, which is requiring reporting, and in that it looks like one of the things will be a recommendation as far as the data. And so I'm just wondering, we don't have I don't know if there's a timeline on that section. I'm looking for that, but it sounds like a lot. This is good information that in the amendment as far as what is being gathered, and I would think that these facilities would kind of be keeping track of a lot of this anyway. Is the idea that we're going to that the department is going to come back with some kind of a plan for data collection?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS, through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is correct. That Section 26, we've heard from advocates and others that they are requesting more information be readily available about how psychiatric care is across the spectrum, so not just at these new facilities, but at hospitals or DET facilities. So we felt like that this approach in Section 26 was the way to get there with everybody. It is a report, but really, as we explained when we rolled out the CS, an action plan. It gives the department and the trust a year to work together with patient advocates, those with lived experience, providers of these services, the Disability Law Center, the ombudsman, to come together to work on things like you just pointed out, grievances, how to put these things, you know, on a public-facing dashboard. We made an improvement, you remember, in the amendment process with something Mr. Gottstein put forward, looking at things that could improve patient outcomes. So there's a lot of items we're looking at because, you know, we want to work together and make sure that we're being as transparent as possible to the public, to the legislature, providing these good metrics, but making sure it's in a way that providers can do this. It can go into their current flow. We're not duplicating anything that's being reported. And that we're not adding an unfunded mandate to anybody as well.
Follow up?
Yes.
And so that is, that's going to be due. Is it going to be due to that recommendation for the data plan by next legislature? Or would it require legislation to be passed? Or once it is decided on, the department will start doing it?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think it could look a couple of different ways, and it's going to depend on what that group comes back and says. And that process for the public that may be listening is lined out on page 13 of version B. We are going to work, you know, and have a public comment period, lots of input, which is really important to this. Some data we may be able to, you know, provide in a de-identified way currently if something needed, you know, legislative action, we would bring that back, you know, as quickly as we could so that could be moved upon. The nice thing is the legislature will know because this is a report to the legislature. So not only will it be a really great public process, so the public should be well informed as we go about this, but we are reporting this to the legislature as well.
All right. And follow up?
Follow up, and then we have Senator Baggage, I think, wanted to chime in on a question.
Okay. And so will that report end up to the legislature, will it provide us any data for the first year as far as, or are we going to kind of not have any data for the first year and just a plan presented? I would think that you would have some sense of what's going on if we are opening some of these outpatient stabilization centers. So would you be coming back with some data in that report?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think as we're creating this together, there'll be data that the department will be able to provide in terms of, you know, we're continuing efforts with our 1115 waiver, where some of these providers are operating on a voluntary basis, so we can provide data there. In terms of if some of these, you know, we stand up in this first year a facility that we'll be able to take involuntary individuals, we'll be able to track those data points through the court system as one data point, you know, how many Title 47s are filed, as well as looking at billings and other things. So I think, yes, we can provide early data, you know, as we're moving along and formalizing what this looks like on a broad scale too.
And then one quick follow-up.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
In the first part of the amendment, the providers are supposed to keep a daily record of the assessment of the individual. Is that already going to happen? Would that be routine? That the person would be checked daily and there'd be something in their medical record as far as their status?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, more so than that, per our behavioral health billings, they actually are observed every 15 minutes. So there's going to be very, you know, extensive notes in patient, you know, records about what is going on every day for an individual.
Every 15 minutes. Wow, thank you.
All right, Senator Baggage and then Senator Reinbold.
I'll just be brief. This is the only comment I'm going to make. Just I want to be sure, Heather, that even though you've described it as de-identified data under this amendment, potentially in some of our smaller rural areas, it might be possible for somebody to identify somebody under what's requested in this amendment. Would that be correct?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, in terms of Amendment 38, yes, you are correct that the department is concerned when you're looking, because these numbers overall are small, that even on a, you know, a reporting on a region could be impossible because you could identify who that individual was, similar to how the department has to be careful about other data we report.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter.
Senator Reinbold.
So, through the chair, first of all, this is, in my opinion, section, you know, on 13, what you guys are doing here is a bureaucratic. It's just bureaucratic stuff. Assess the current state and federality of accrediting body. And two, it's just recommend changes. Number three is assess and recommend current processes for collection of grievances. It's just a process thing. And then it goes on in B to talk about develop an assessment with diverse stakeholders and talk to the public. You know, it's just all bureaucratic, in my opinion. What this actually does, the amendment does, is it actually deals with the patient. Every single one of my amendments, the intent is to protect patients' rights, is to make sure that they're not getting in situations that basically their rights are being violated in regards to their constitutional rights. So what this does is it actually deals with health outcome metrics. This is patient-centered. This is bureaucratic-centered. This is patient-centered. So I think it's ridiculous. If people are locked up in a facility, the whole community is going to know anyway. So it's just ridiculous that, you know, by picking them up and putting them in a residential center, they're going to know. So basically what page 11, line 4 does is this is a new section. This causes it to be on an objective scale. That's on page 1, line 10. So they can't just do willy-nilly stuff. They actually have to use an objective scale relating to an individual's ability to function in society. Will you be doing stuff like that? That's question number one. In this reporting on 26, will you, with the assessment, be using objective scale relating to an individual's ability to function in society?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, we will look at scales that are, you know, industry standard, looking at how things are going to be metric or you know, by current practice. I think how you have this worded is a little confusing in terms of objective scale relating to an individual's ability to function in society. I'm not exactly sure, you know, objective by who is deciding that. So we will be looking at what are the best practices. You know, what is the industry standard? So we have a really data-informed, you know, a scale when we're looking at things and coming back with solid recommendations to move forward.
Senator Rumble.
So basically you've gotten me even more concerned than I was before, because now you're saying you don't want objective scales. It sounds like that, because basically that's more subjective. People want objective scales relating. And that's why I think that this amendment is so important, because there's been a lot of abuse in mental facilities. You know that. You know, look at APL. Go look at the audits. They're pretty horrible. And the number of complaints from ombudsmans, I think that if this bill is passed right now, we're going to look back and say, oh, my gosh, this has got to be repealed. And that's what I think we're headed with this bill, if it's in the current way that it is. B, it says these patients, are you going to be recording the number of how many were involuntarily detained, the number of patients whose psychotropic medications were administered without informed consent, and the number of patients physically restrained, patient complaint, patient injuries, and traumatic events experienced by the patient. Once again, every single one of my amendments is to protect the patient. Are you going to be doing what is in B, yes or no?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the report is going to look at those items that I referenced. It's going to look at those items and talking about, you know, yes, how can we look at this and provide this information publicly, looking at restraints, complaints, or grievances, how we word it, injuries. Those are all items that we're going to be looking at, and that is not limited to just those things, because I think as we talk about this, we're going to see, you know, what else do we need to consider? So that is also why the department and the trust is suggesting we do this report to really get it right and comprehensive the first time.
So can I clarify that?
So
yes, it sounds like you will be doing the health facilities. It says shall record the number of patients involuntarily detained, the number of patients to whom psychotropic medications is administered without informed consent, the number of patients physically restrained, patient complaints, patient injuries, traumatic events experienced by the patient. You are saying, yes, you will be documenting that. So if I call you guys and say, can I see this report, then that will be available. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I think you are, you know, confusing me with how you're rephrasing things, but the report is going to look at these items and talk about moving forward and how we provide this information on a broad scale. You know, of course we're going to be looking at the number of patients who are on an involuntary detention or hold, because that is what we are doing through this bill in the court process. And, you know, anytime crisis medication is used, as Mr. Bookman, you know, talked about with other amendments, yes, it's going to be well documented and all of that. So, and again, the report that is on page 13 of the CS is talking heavily about looking at gathering, you know, times of restraint, complaints, grievances, and talking about what changes need to be made to that process, how we provide this information, you know, publicly for individuals who are tracking this work, as well as the legislature.
And I'll quickly call up as we get to Senator Hughes's question here. I think the Alaska court system also has data on their involuntary information, and we can ask the court system what information that they are held as. As she walks up here, Senator Hughes, your question?
Yeah, I just want to say I hadn't really noticed what Senator Begich did in small communities, but it would actually be making public information, private medical information. You could figure out if a person received meds, if they were restrained, kind of things that I don't think should be out there in the public. But the other thing that's reassuring about Section 26, I don't see it all as bureaucratic, because it's looking at patient rights, patient grievance, etc. And also the department has to bring together a diverse stakeholder group, and that would include patient advocates. So I'm going to get someone like Mr. Godstein would be at the table for that, the Disability Law Center. So you're going to have people that have the same concerns that we have as far as making sure that the patient's rights are upheld and that people aren't being held that could be in function in society. So for that reason, I think that stakeholder group will bring together a good set of data. If it were just the department or just the people running these clinics, I would be worried. But the group that they have to assemble will make sure that the very things that we're concerned about will be part of the data plan. So I'll be opposing the amendment.
And Ms. Mead, if you can just quickly just confirm which data is available in the court records keep in terms of involuntary commitments, if they that number is kept.
To the chair for the record, Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. The direct answer is yes, we keep track by petition or by statute number, you could say, of, well, of everything that comes into the court system, but I could tell you on an annual basis how many ex parte orders we have for an involuntary commitment for a 3-day, a 30-day, a 90-day, et cetera. We do have that data.
Thank you. In closing, Senator Reinbold.
So basically, I think some people are wishing that what section on page 11, or excuse me, page 13, that they're thinking that it might do, but in reality, it's just assess the current state, recommend changes, assess and recommend, develop a process with diverse stakeholders. It's willy-nilly. What this actually does, this amendment, it actually is a health outcomes metrics where it's using objective data. So the first part is all about the patients and how they're doing it on a daily basis. And then the second part of it, it prevents abuses because basically we'll have a real number in regards to how many patients are involuntarily detained, the number of patients whom psychotropic medication is administered without informed consent, the number of patients that are physically restrained, which, you know, is not fun, I'm sure, for the patients, the patient complaints, the injuries, so it gives them very specific things to look at. And then in C, it says that it's aggregate data that's gathered without disclosing information that would identify the individual. So to me, this is just protects. It's excellent. To me, this is one of the best amendments of the whole bill, and it will be on the House floor or the Senate floor if this bill moves along. But with that, I think it's very, very important because it's very clear to not disclose any of that because it's the aggregate data. So with that, for the patient advocates and people who have been abused in the system, this is an amendment for them, and with that, I strongly urge a yes vote on amendment number 38.
All right. With that, we'll do a roll call vote.
Yes.
Senator Begich?
No.
No.
No. On a vote of one yay and three nays, Amendment 39 fails. Brings us to Amendment 39. Senator Reinbold.
I move Amendment number 39.
Hearing no objection, Amendment 39 passes. With that, that concludes our business for today. On our next meeting, on next Tuesday, we will take up SB 175, telehealth. Again, SB 124. And then SB 184, Settlement Trust and Benefits, by Senator Begich's office. SB 175 is by my office, and SB 124 is a bill that we just got done with today, and that was introduced by the governor's office. We'll also take introduction, invited testimony, and public testimony on SB 216, Dementia Awareness, by Senator Costello's office. With that, that concludes our business, and we are adjourned at 3:03 p.m.